That wouldn't have done. The corruption of the border guards went both ways. They might well have told their superiors about things while sharing the requisite percentage of the loot from their informal tariff collection. And so the representative merely sat in the right seat of the truck while the driver handled business. Out the back of the truck, in this case, an offer to the guards of a selection of his cargo. They weren't the least bit greedy about it, instead taking little more than they could easily conceal in the back of their personal automobiles. The only concession to the illegality of the entire business was that it took place at night. With that, the proper stamps were affixed to the proper documents, and the truck pulled off, heading down the cross-border highway, which was probably the only decently surfaced road in the area. The remaining drive took a little over an hour, and then, entering the large town which had once serviced the caravan trade, the truck stopped briefly, and the representative got out and walked to a private automobile to continue his journey, carrying only a small bag with a change of clothes or two. The president of this semi-autonomous republic claimed to be a Muslim, but he was mainly an opportunist, a former senior party official who, as a matter of course, had denied God regularly to ensure his political advancement, and then, with the changing of the political wind, embraced Islam with public enthusiasm and private disinterest. His faith, if one could call it that, was entirely about his secular well-being. There were several passages in the Quran concerning such people, none of them flattering. He lived a comfortable life in a comfortable personal palace, which had once quartered the party boss of this former Soviet republic. In that official residence, he drank liquor, fornicated, and ruled his republic with a hand that was by turns too firm and too gentle. Too firmly he controlled the regional economy. With his communist training, he was hopelessly inept. And too gently he allowed Islam to flourish, so he thought, to give his people the illusion of personal freedom. And in that he clearly misunderstood the nature of the Islamic faith he professed to have, for Islamic law was written to apply to the secular as well as the spiritual. Like all presidents before him, he thought himself beloved of his people. It was, the representative knew, a common illusion of fools. In due course, the representative arrived at the modest private home of a friend of the local religious leader. This was a man of simple faith and quiet honor, beloved by all who knew him and disliked by no one. For his was a kindly voice in most things, and his occasional anger was founded on principles that even unbelievers could respect. In his middle 50s, he'd suffered at the hands of the previous regime, but never wavered in the strength of his beliefs. He was perfectly suited to the task at hand, and around him were his closest associates. There were the usual greetings in God's holy name, followed by the serving of tea, and then it was time for business. "It is a sad thing," the representative began, "to see the faithful living in such poverty." "It has always been so, but today we can practice our religion in freedom. My people are coming back to the faith. Our mosques have been repaired, and every day they are more full." "What are material possessions compared to the faith?" the local leader responded, with the reasonable voice of a teacher. "So true, that is," the representative agreed. "And yet Allah wishes for his faithful to prosper, does he not?" There was general agreement. Every man in the room was an Islamic scholar, and few prefer poverty to comfort. "Most of all, my people need schools, proper schools," was the reply. "We need better medical facilities. I grow weary of consoling the parents of a dead child who needed not to have died. We need many things. I do not deny that." "All these things are easily provided." "If one has money," the representative pointed out. "But this has always been a poor land. We have resources, yes, but they have never been properly exploited. And now we have lost the support of the central government. At the very moment when we have the freedom to control our own destiny, while that fool of a president we have gets drunk and abuses women in his palace. If only he were a just man, a faithful man, for then we might bring prosperity to this land, he observed, more in sadness than in anger. That, and a little foreign capital, one of the more economically literate of his retinue suggested modestly. Islam has never had a rule against commercial activity. Though it is remembered by the West for spreading by the sword, it had gone east on the ships of traders, much as Christianity had spread through the word and example of its own adherents. In Tehran it is thought that the time has come for the faithful to act as the Prophet commands. We have made the error common to unbelievers, of thinking in terms of national greed rather than the needs of all people. My own teacher, Mahmud Haji Daryai, has preached of the need to return to the foundations of our faith, the representative said, sipping his tea. He spoke as a teacher himself, his voice quiet. Passion he saved for the public arena. In a closed room, sitting on the floor with men as learned as himself, he too spoke only with reason's voice. We have wealth, such wealth as only Allah could have awarded by his own plan, and now we have the moment as well. You men in this room, you kept the faith, honored the word in the face of persecution, while others of us grew rich. It is now our obligation to reward you, to welcome you back into the fold, to share our bounty with you. That is what my teacher proposes. It is good to hear such words, was the cautious reply. That the man was primarily a man of God did not make him naive. He guarded his thoughts with the greatest care. Growing up under communist rule had taught him that, but what he had to be thinking was obvious. It is our hope to unite all Islam under one roof, to bring the faithful together as the Prophet Muhammad, blessings and peace be upon him, desired. We are different in place, in language, often in color, but in our faith we are one. We are the elect of Allah. And so? And so we wish your republic to join our own, so that we may be as one. We will bring you schools and medical assistance for your people. We will help you take control of your own land, so that what we give you will be returned to all manifold, and we shall be as the brothers Allah intends us to be. The casual Western observer might have remarked that these men all appeared unsophisticated, due to their less than splendid clothing, their simple mode of speech, or merely the fact that they sat on the floor. Such was not exactly the case, and what the visitor from Iran proposed was hardly less startling than an embassy from another planet might have been. There were differences between his nation and this one, between his people and theirs. Language and culture, for starters. They had fought wars over the centuries. There had been banditry and brigandage. This despite the most serious strictures in the Holy Quran about armed conflict between Islamic nations. There was, in fact, virtually no common ground between them at all, except for one. That one might have been called accidental, but the truly faithful didn't believe in accidents. When Russia, first under the Tsars and then under Marxism-Leninism, had conquered their land, a lengthy process rather than an event, they'd stripped so much away. Culture, for one. History and heritage. Everything but language. A sop to what the Soviets for generations had uneasily called the nationalities question. They'd brought schooling aimed first at destroying everything, and then at rebuilding it in a new and godless mode, until the only unifying force left to the people was their faith, which they'd tried hard to suppress. And even that was good, they all thought now, because the faith could never be suppressed, and such attempts only made the truly faithful more determined. It might even had to have been a plan from Allah himself to show the people that their one salvation could only be the faith. Now they were coming back to it, to the leaders who had kept the flame alight. And now, all in the room reflected, as their visitor knew they must, Allah himself had washed away their petty differences so that they could unify as their God wished. So much the better to do so with the promise of material prosperity, as charity was one of the pillars of Islam, and so long denied by people calling themselves faithful to the Holy Word. And now the Soviet Union was dead, and its successor state crippled, and the distant and unloved children of Moscow left largely on their own, all of them governed by an echo of what was gone. If it were not a sign from Allah that this opportunity should present itself, then what was it, they all asked themselves? They only had to do one thing to bring it all about. And he was an unbeliever. And Allah would judge him through their hands. And although I can't say that I liked the way you treated my Boston College Eagles last October, Ryan said with a smile, to the assembled NCAA football champions from the University of Oklahoma at Norman, your tradition of excellence is part of the American soul, which hadn't been much of a pleasure for the University of Florida in the last Orange Bowl in a 35-10 blowout. And the people applauded again. Jack was so pleased by this that he almost forgot the fact that the speech was not really his. His smile, crooked teeth and all, lit up the arena, and he waved his right hand, this time not tentatively. One could tell the difference on the C-SPAN cameras. "He's a fast learner," Ed Keelty said. He was objective about such matters. His public face was one thing, but politicians are realists, at least in the tactical sense. "He's very well coached, remember," the former vice president's chief of staff reminded his boss. "They don't come any better than Arnie. Our initial play got their attention, Ed, and Van Damme must have laid the word on Ryan pretty hard and pretty fast." He didn't have to add that their play had gone nowhere fast after that. The newspapers had written their initial editorials, but then reflected a little and backed off. Not editorially, since the media rarely admits to error, but the news stories coming from the White House press room, if not praising Ryan, hadn't used the usual assassination buzzwords. Unsure, confused, disorganized, and the like. No White House with Arnie Van Damme in it would ever be disorganized, and the whole Washington establishment knew it. Ryan's major cabinet appointments had shaken things up, but then the officials had all started doing the right things. Adler was another insider who'd worked his way to the top. As a junior official, he'd briefed in too many foreign affairs correspondents over the years for them to turn on him, and he never lost a chance to extol Ryan's expertise on foreign policy. George Winston, outsider and plutocrat though he was, had initiated a quiet re-examination of his entire department, and Winston had on his Rolodex the number of every financial editor from Berlin to Tokyo, and was seeking out their views and counsel on his internal study. Most surprising of all was Tony Brentano in the Pentagon. A vociferous outsider for the last 10 years, he'd promised the defense reporting community that he'd clean out the temple or die in the attempt, that the Pentagon was wasteful now, as they'd always proclaimed, but that he, with the president's approval, was going to do his damnedest to decorrupt the acquisition process once and for all. It was a singularly uncharming collection of people, Washington outsiders all. But, damn it, they were charming the media in the best possible way, quietly, in the back rooms of power. Most disturbingly of all, the Washington Post, an internal spy had told Keelty earlier in the day, was preparing a multi-part story about Ryan's history at CIA. And it would be a canonization piece by no less than Bob Holtzman. Holtzman was the quintessential media insider, and, for reasons unknown, he liked Ryan personally. And he had one hell of a source inside somewhere. That was the Trojan horse. If the story ran, and if it were picked up around the nation, both likely, since it would increase the prestige both of Holtzman and the Post, then his media contacts would back away rapidly. The editorials would counsel him to withdraw his claim for the good of the nation, and he'd have no leverage at all, and his political career would end in greater disgrace than he'd accepted only a short time before. Historians who might have overlooked his personal indiscretions would instead focus on his overreaching ambition, and instead of seeing it as an irregularity, would then fold it back into his entire career, questioning everything he'd ever done, seeing him in a different and unfavorable light at every step, saying that the good things he'd done were the irregularities. Keelty wasn't so much looking into his political grave as that eternal damnation. "You left out Callie," Ed grumped, still watching the speech, listening to the content and paying close attention to the delivery. Academic, he thought, fitting for an audience mainly of students, who cheered this Ryan as though he were a football coach or someone of similar irrelevance. "One of her speeches could make Pee-wee Herman look presidential," the chief of staff agreed. And that was the greatest danger of all. To win, Ryan just had to appear presidential, whether he really was or not. And he wasn't, of course, as Keelty kept reminding himself. How could he be? "I never said he was stupid," Keelty admitted. He had to be objective. This wasn't a game anymore. It was even more than life. "It's gotta happen soon, Ed." "I know." But he had to have something bigger to shoot, Keelty told himself. It was a curious metaphor for someone who'd advocated gun control all of his political life. Chapter 25. Blooms. The farm had come with a barn. It mainly served as a garage now. Ernie Brown had been in the construction business, and had earned a good deal of money, first in the late 1970s as a union plumber. Then he'd established his own business in the 1980s to partake in the California building boom. Though a pair of divorces had depleted his funds, the selling of the business had been well-timed, and he'd taken the money and run, and bought a sizable parcel of land in an area not yet chic enough to have its property values driven up by Hollywood types. What had resulted was almost a full section, a square mile, of privacy. Actually, more than that, because the neighboring ranches were dormant at this time of year, the pastures frozen, and the cattle in pens comfortably eating silage. You could go several days without seeing so much as another car on the road, or so it seemed out in Big Sky country. School buses, they told themselves, didn't count. A 5-ton flatbed truck also had been conveyed with the ranch, a diesel, conveniently enough, along with a buried 2,000-gallon fuel tank right by the barn. The family, which had sold off the ranch and barn and house to the newcomer from California, hadn't known that they were giving over title to a bomb factory. The first order of business for Ernie and Pete was to get the old truck started up. That proved to be a 40-minute exercise, because it wasn't just a case of a dead battery, but Pete Holbrook was a competent mechanic, and in due course the truck's engine roared to unmuffled life and showed every sign of remaining with the living. The truck was not licensed, but that wasn't terribly unusual in this area of huge holdings, and their drive of 40 miles north to the farm supply store was untroubled. It could hardly have been a better portent of spring for the store. Planting season was coming. There were a lot of wheat farmers around, and here was the first major customer for the virtual mountain of fertilizer just trucked in from the distributor's warehouse in Helena. The men bought 4 tons, not an unusual quantity, which a propane-powered forklift deposited on the flatbed of the truck. And they paid cash for it, then drove off with a handshake and a smile. This is going to be hard work, Holbrook observed, halfway back.
That's right, and we're going to do it all ourselves. Brown turned. Or do you want to bring in somebody who might be an informer?
I hear you, Ernie, Pete replied, as a state police car went the other way. The cop didn't even turn his head, chilling though the moment was for the two mountain men.
How much more?
Brown had done the calculations a dozen times.
One more truckload. It's a shame this stuff is so bulky.
They'd make the second purchase tomorrow, at a store 30 miles southwest of the ranch. This evening would be busy enough unloading all this crap inside the barn. A good workout. Why didn't the goddamn farm have a forklift? Holbrook wondered. At least when they refilled the fuel tank, the local oil company would do it. That was some consolation. It was cold on the Chinese coast, and that made things easier for the satellites to see a series of thermal blooms at two naval bases. Actually, the Chinese Navy was the naval service of the People's Liberation Army. So gross a disregard for tradition that Western navies ignored the correct name in favor of custom. The imagery was recorded and cross-linked to the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon, where the senior watch officer turned to his intelligence specialist.
Do the Chinese have an exercise laid on?
Not that we know of. The photos showed that 12 ships, all of them alongside, had their engines running, instead of the normal procedure by which they drew electrical power from the dock. A closer look at the photo showed a half-dozen tugboats moving around the harbor as well. The intel specialist for this watch was Army. He called a naval officer over.
Sailing some ships, was the obvious analysis.
Not just doing an engineering exam or something?
They wouldn't need tugboats for that.
When's the next pass, the Navy commander asked, meaning a satellite pass, checking the time reference on the photo. It was 30 minutes old.
50 minutes.
Then it ought to show 3 or maybe 4 ships standing out to sea at both bases.
That'll make it certain.
For right now, 2 chances out of 3 they're laying on a major exercise.
He paused.
Any political hoorah going on? The senior watch officer shook his head.
Nothing.
Then it's a fleet X. Maybe somebody decided to check out their readiness. They would learn more with a press release from Beijing, but that was 30 minutes into a future they couldn't see, paid though they were to do so. The director was a religious man, as was to be expected, what with the sensitivity of his post. Gifted physician that he had been, and scientist-virologist that he still was, he lived in a country where political reliability was measured by devotion to the Shia branch of Islam. And in this there was no doubt. His prayers were always on time, and he scheduled his laboratory work around them. He required the same of his people, for such was his devotion that he went beyond the teachings of Islam without even knowing it, bending such rules as stood in his way, as though they were made of rubber, and at the same time telling himself that no, he never violated the Prophet's holy word or Allah's will. How could he be doing that? He was helping to bring the world back to the faith. The prisoners, the experimental subjects, were all condemned men in one way or another. Even the thieves, lesser criminals, had 4 times violated the Holy Quran, and they had probably committed other crimes as well. Perhaps, probably, he told himself, those worthy of death. Every day they were informed of the time for prayer, and though they knelt and bowed and mouthed the prayers, you could tell by watching them on the TV monitor that they were merely going through the ritual, not truly praying to Allah in the manner prescribed. That made them all apostates, and apostasy was a capital crime in their country, even though only one had been convicted of that crime. That one was of the Baha'i religion, a minority almost stamped out, a belief structure that had evolved after Islam. Christians and Jews were at least people of the book. However misguided their religions, at least they acknowledged the same God of the universe, of whom Muhammad was the final messenger. The Baha'i had come later, inventing something both new and false that relegated them to the status of pagans, denying the true faith, and earning the wrath of their government. It was fitting that this man was the first to show that the experiment was successful. It was remarkable that the prisoners were so brain-dulled by their conditions that the onset of flu symptoms caused no special reaction at first. The medical corpsman went in, as always in full protective gear, to take blood samples. And one additional benefit of the prisoners' condition was that they were far too cowed to make trouble. All of them had been in prison for some time, subject to a deficient diet which had its own effects on their energy levels, plus a discipline regime so harsh that they didn't dare resist. Even the condemned prisoners, who knew they faced death, had no wish to accelerate the process. All meekly submitted to having their blood drawn by exquisitely careful medics. The test tubes were carefully labeled in accordance with the numbers on the beds, and the medics withdrew. In the lab, it was patient 3's blood which went under the microscope first. The antibody test was prone to give some false positive readings, and this was too important to risk error. So slides were prepared and placed under the electron microscopes, first set at magnification 20,000 for area search. The fine adjustments for the instruments were handled by exquisitely machined gears, as the slide was moved left and right, up and down, until... "Ah," the director said. He centered the target in the viewing field and increased the magnification to 112,000. And there it was, projected onto the computer monitor in black-and-white display. His culture knew much of shepherding, and the aphorism, "Shepherd's Crook," seemed to him a perfect description. Centered was the RNA strand, thin and curved at the bottom, with the protein loops at the top. These were the key to the action of the virus, or so everyone thought. Their precise function was not understood, and that also pleased the director's identity as a bio-war technician. "Modi," he called. "Yes, I see it," the younger doctor said, with a slow nod, as he walked to that side of the room. Ebola Zaire Mayinga was in the apostate's blood. He'd just run the antibody test as well, and watched the tiny sample change color. This one was not a false positive. "Airborne transmission is confirmed." "Agreed." Modi's face didn't change. He was not surprised. "We will wait another day. No, 2 days for the second phase. And then we will know." For now, he had a report to make. The announcement in Beijing caught the American embassy by surprise. It was couched in routine terms. The Chinese Navy would be holding a major exercise in the Taiwan Strait. There would be some live firings of surface-to-air and surface-to-surface missiles on dates yet unspecified. Weather conditions had yet to be resolved, the release said. The People's Republic of China government was issuing notice to airmen and notice to mariner alerts, so that both airlines and shipping companies would be able to adjust their routings accordingly. Other than that, the release said nothing at all, and that was somewhat disturbing to the deputy chief of mission in Beijing. The DCM immediately conferred with his military attachés and the CIA chief of station, none of whom had any insights to offer, except that the release had nothing at all to say about the Republic of China government on Taiwan. On the one hand, that was good news. There was no complaint about the continued political independence of what Beijing deemed a rebel province. On the other hand, it was bad news. The release did not say that this was a routine exercise and not intended to disturb anyone. The notice was just that, with no explanation at all attached to it. The information was dispatched to the NMCC in the Pentagon, to the State Department, and to CIA headquarters at Langley. Daryai had to search his memory for the face that went with the name. And the face he remembered was the wrong one, really, for it was that of a boy from Qum, and the message came from a grown man half a world away. Rahman. Oh, yes, Arif Rahman. What a bright lad he'd been. His father had been a dealer in automobiles, Mercedes cars, and had sold them in Tehran to the powerful, a man whose faith had wavered. But his sons had not. His son had not even blinked on learning of the death of his parents, killed by accident, really, at the hands of the Shah's army, for having been on the wrong street at the wrong time, caught up in a civil disturbance in which they'd had no part at all. Together, he and his teacher had prayed for them. Dead by the hands of those they trusted was the lesson from that event, but the lesson had not been a necessary one. Rahman had already been a lad of deep faith, offended by the fact that his elder sister had taken up with an American officer, and so disgraced her family and his own name. She, too, had disappeared in the revolution, condemned by an Islamic court for adultery, which left only the son. They could have used him in many ways, but the chosen one had been Daryai's own doing. Linked up with two elderly people, the new family had fled the country with the Rahman family wealth and gone first to Europe and then almost immediately thereafter to America. There they had done nothing more than live quietly. Daryai imagined they were dead by now. The son, selected for the mission because of his early mastery of English, had continued his education and entered government service, performing his duties with all the excellence he'd displayed in the revolution's earliest phases, during which he'd killed two senior officers in the Shah's Air Force while they drank whiskey in a hotel bar. Since then, he'd done as he'd been told. Nothing. Blend in. Disappear. Remember your mission, but do nothing. It was gratifying for the Ayatollah that he'd judged the boy well, for now he knew from the brief message that the mission was almost fully accomplished. The word assassin is itself derived from hashash, the Arabic word for the narcotic hashish, the tool once used by members of the Nizari subsect of Islam to give themselves a drug-induced vision of paradise prior to setting out on missions of murder. In fact, they'd been heretics to Daryai's way of thinking, and the use of drugs was an abomination. They'd been weak-minded but effective servants of a series of master terrorists such as Hassan and Rashid Adin, and, for a time that stretched between two centuries, had served the political balance of power in a region stretching from Syria to Persia. But there was a brilliance in the concept which had fascinated the cleric since learning of it as a boy. To get one faithful agent inside the enemy's camp. It was the task of years, and for that reason a task of faith. Where the Nizaris had failed was that they were heretics, separate from the true faith, able to recruit a few extremists into their cult, but not the multitude. And so they served a single man and not Allah. And so they needed drugs to fortify themselves, as an unbeliever did with liquor. A brilliant idea flawed, but a brilliant idea nonetheless. Daryai had merely perfected it, and so now he had a man close, something he'd hoped for but not known. Better yet, he had a man close and waiting for instructions, at the far end of an unknown message path that had never been used, all composed of people who'd gone abroad no more recently than 15 years ago. An altogether better state of affairs than that which he'd set in place in Iraq. For in America, people who might be scrutinized were either arrested or cleared. Or if they were watched, only for a little while, until the watchers became bored and went on to other tasks. In some countries, when that happened, the watchers became bored, picked up those whom they watched, and frequently killed them. So it was just timing before Rahman completed his mission, and after all these years he still used his head, unaddled by drugs and trained by the great Satan himself. The news was too sublime even to occasion a smile. Then the phone rang, the private one.
Yes?
I have good news, the director said, from the monkey farm.
You know, Arnie, you were right, Jack said, in the breezeway to the West Wing. It was great to get the hell out of here.
The chief of staff noted the spring in his step, but didn't get overly excited about it. Air Force One had brought the president back in time for a quiet dinner with his family, instead of the usual rigors of three or four such speeches, endless hours of schmoozing with major contributors, and the usual four-hour night that resulted. And that, often enough, in the aircraft, followed by a quick shower and a working day artificially extended by the revelries in the hustings. It was remarkable, he thought, that any president was able to do any work at all. The real duties of the office were difficult enough, and those were almost always subordinated to what was little more than public relations, albeit a necessary function in a democracy, in which the people needed to see the president doing more than sitting at his desk and doing his work. The presidency was a job which one could love without liking it, a phrase seemingly contradictory until you came here and saw it.
You did just fine, Van Damme said. The stuff on TV was perfect, and the segment NBC ran with your wife was okay, too.
She didn't like it. She didn't think they used her best line, Ryan reported lightly.
Could have been a lot worse.
They didn't ask her about abortion, Arnie thought. To keep that from happening, he'd used up a few large markers with NBC, and made sure that Tom Donner had been treated at least as well as a senator, maybe even a cabinet member, on the flight the previous day, including a rare taped segment in flight. The following week, Donner would be the first network anchor to have a one-on-one with the president in the upstairs sitting room, and for that there was no agreement on the scope of the questions, meaning that Ryan would have to be briefed for hours to make sure he didn't step on the presidential crank. But for now the chief of staff allowed his president to bask in the afterglow of what had been a pretty good day in the Midwest, whose real mission, aside from getting Ryan out of Washington and so get a feel for what the presidency really was to have him look like a president and further marginalize that bastard Keelty. The Secret Service people were as upbeat as their president, as they so often drew their mood from POTUS, returning his smiles and nods with spoken greetings of their own. "Good morning, Mr. President," repeated by four of them as Ryan passed, finding his way to the Oval Office. "Good morning, Ben," Ryan said cheerily, heading to his desk and falling into the comfortable swivel chair. "Tell me how the world looks."
"We may have a problem. The PRC Navy's putting to sea," the acting National Security Advisor said.
The Secret Service had just assigned him a code name, Card Sharp.
"And?" Ryan asked, annoyed that the morning might be spoiled.
"And it looks like a major fleet exercise, and they're saying there will be live-fire missile shoots. No reaction from Taipei yet."
"They don't have elections or anything coming up, do they?" Jack asked.
Goodley shook his head.
"No, not for another year. The ROC has continued to spend money with the UN, and they're quietly lobbying a lot of countries in case they go through with a request for representation. But nothing remarkable about that either. Taipei is playing its cards close to the vest, and not making any noise to offend the mainland. Their commercial relationship is stable. In short, we have no explanation for the exercise."
"What do we have in the area?"
"One submarine in the Formosa Strait, keeping an eye on a Chinese SSN.
"Carriers?"
"Nothing closer than the Indian Ocean. Stennis is back in Pearl for engine repairs, along with Enterprise, and they'll be there for a while. The cupboard is still pretty bare."
Card Sharp reminded the president what he had himself said to his president only months before.
"What about their army?" the president asked next.
"Again, nothing new. We have higher-than-usual levels of activity, like the Russian said, but that's been going on for a while."
Ryan leaned back in his chair and contemplated a cup of decaf. He'd found on his speechifying trip that his stomach really did feel better that way, and remarked on it to Kathy, who'd merely smiled and said, "I told you so."
Okay, Ben, speculate.
I talked it over with some China people at State and the agency, Goodley replied. Maybe their military is making a political move. Interior politics, I mean, increasing their readiness state to let the other people on the Beijing Politburo know that they're still around and still matter. Aside from that, anything else is pure speculation, and I'm not supposed to do that here, boss, remember?
And don't know means don't know, doesn't it?
It was a rhetorical question, and one of Ryan's favored aphorisms.
You taught me that on the other side of the river, Mr. President, Goodley agreed, but without the expected smile.
You also taught me not to like things I can't explain. The National Intelligence Officer paused.
They know we'll know, and they know we'll be interested, and they know you're new here, and they know you don't need a hassle.
So why do it? Goodley asked, also rhetorically.
Yeah, the President agreed quietly.
Andrea, he said. Price, as usual, was in the room, pretending not to pay attention.
Yes, sir.
"Where's the nearest smoker?" Ryan said it entirely without shame.
"Mr. President, I don't—"
"Oh, the hell you don't. I want one." Price nodded and disappeared into the secretary's room. She knew the signs as well as anyone. Switching from regular coffee to decaf, and now a smoke. In a way it was surprising that it had taken this long, and it told her more about the intelligence briefing than the words of Dr. Benjamin Goodley did. It had to be a woman smoker, the President saw a minute later. Another one of the thin ones. Price even brought a match and an ashtray, along with her disapproving look. He wondered if they'd acted the same way with FDR and Eisenhower. Ryan took his first drag deep in thought. China had been the silent partner in the conflict. He still couldn't use the word war, not even in his own mind, with Japan. At least that was the supposition. It all made sense, and it all fitted together nicely, but there was no proof of the sort to flesh out a SNI, a special national intelligence estimate, much less present to the media, which often as not required the same degree of reliability as an especially conservative judge.
So, Ryan lifted the phone. I want Director Murray.
One of the nice things about the presidency was the use of the telephone. Please hold for the President, a simple phrase spoken by a White House secretary in the same voice one might use for ordering out a pizza, never failed to cause an instant, almost panicked reaction on the other end of whatever line she might use. It rarely took longer than 10 seconds to get the call through. This time it took 6.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Morning, Dan. I need something. What's the name of that Japanese police inspector who came over?
Jisaburo Tanaka, Murray replied at once.
Is he any good? Jack said next.
Solid. As good as anybody I have working here.
What do you want from him?
I presume they're talking a lot with that Yamada guy.
You may safely assume that a wild bear goes potty in the woods too, Mr. President, the acting director of the FBI managed to say without a laugh.
I want to know about his conversations with China, especially who his contact was.
That we can do.
I'll try to get him right now.
Call back to you?
No, brief Ben Goodley in, and he'll coordinate with the people down the hall, Ryan said, using an old catchphrase between the two.
Ben's here now in my old office.
Yes, sir, let me do it now.
It's heading up to midnight in Tokyo.
Thanks, Dan. Bye.
Jack put the phone back.
Let's start figuring this one out.
You got it, boss, Goodley promised.
Anything else happening in the world?
Iraq?
Same news as yesterday. Lots of people executed. The Russians fed us this United Islamic Republic thing, and we all think it likely, but no overt move yet.
That's what I'd planned to do today, and...
Okay, then, get to it.
"Okay, what's the drill for this?" Tony Britano asked.
Robbie Jackson didn't especially like doing things on the fly, but that was the job of the newly promoted J-3, Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In the previous week, he'd come to like the designate Secretary of Defense.
Brentano was one tough-minded little guy, but his snarl was mainly for show, and concealed a very thoughtful brain able to make quick decisions. And the man was an engineer. He knew what he didn't know, and was quick to ask questions.
"We have Pasadena, fast attack sub, in the strait already doing routine surveillance. We break her off the current job of trailing the PRC SSN and have her move northwest. Next, we move two or three additional boats into the area, assign them operating areas, and let them keep an eye on things. We open a line of communications with Taipei and have them feed us what they see and know. They'll play ball. They always do. Ordinarily, we'd move a carrier a little closer, but this time, well, we don't have one very close. And absent a political threat to Taiwan, it would appear to be an overreaction. We stage electronics intelligence aircraft over the area out of Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. We're hampered by the lack of a nearby base.
So, essentially, we gather intelligence information and do nothing substantive? The SecDef asked.
Gathering intelligence is substantive, sir, but yes.
Brentano smiled. I know. I built the satellites you'll be using. What will they tell us?
We'll probably get a lot of in-the-clear chatter that'll use up every Mandarin speaker they have at Fort Meade, and tell us not very much about their overall intentions. The operational stuff will be useful. It'll tell us a lot about their capabilities. If I know Admiral Mancuso, Comsubpac, he'll have one or two of his boats play a little fast and loose to see if the Chinese can acquire one and prosecute it. But nothing overt. That's one of our options if we don't like the way this exercise is going.
What do you mean?
I mean, if you really want to put the fear of God in a naval officer, you let him know there's a submarine around. Which is to say, Mr. Secretary, one appears unexpectedly in the middle of your formation and immediately disappears again. It's a head game and a nasty one. Our people are good at that, and Bart Mancuso knows how to use his boats. We couldn't have defeated the Japanese without him, Jackson said positively.
He's that good.
Mancuso was just a name to the new SecDef.
None better. He's one of the people you listen to. So's your sync pack, Dave Seaton.
Admiral DeMarco told me.
Sir, may I speak freely? The J-3 asked.
Jackson, in here that's the only way.
Bruno DeMarco was made Vice Chief of Naval Operations for a reason.
Brentano got it at once.
Oh, to give speeches and not do anything that can hurt the Navy?
Robbie's reply was a nod.
Noted, Admiral Jackson.
Sir, I don't know much about industry, but there's something you need to learn about this building. There's two kinds of officer in the Pentagon, operators and bureaucrats. Admiral DeMarco has been here for more than half of his career. Mancuso and Seaton are operators, and they try very hard to stay out of this building.
So have you, Brentano observed.
I guess I just like the smell of salt air, Mr. Secretary.
I'm not polishing my own apple here, sir. You'll decide if you like me or not. What the hell, I'm out of the flying business anyway. And that's what I signed up to do. But damn it, when Seaton and Mancuso talk, I hope you'll listen.
What's the matter with you, Robbie? The SecDef asked with sudden concern. He knew a good employee when he saw one.
Jackson shrugged.
Arthritis. Runs in the family.
Could be worse, sir. It won't hurt my golf game. And flag officers don't get to fly very much anyway.
You don't care about getting promoted, do you?
Brentano was about to recommend another star for Jackson.
Mr. Secretary, I'm the son of a preacher man in Mississippi. I got into Annapolis, flew fighters for 20 years, and I'm still alive to talk about it.
All too many of his friends were not. A fact Robbie never forgot.
I can retire whenever I want and get a good job. I figure I'm ahead of the game, whatever happens. But America's been pretty good to me, and I owe something back. What I owe, sir, is to tell the truth and do my best and screw the consequences.
So you're not a bureaucrat either.
Brentano wondered what Jackson's degree was in.
He sure talked like a competent engineer. He even smiled like one.
I'd rather play piano in a whorehouse, sir. It's more honest work.
We're going to get along, Robbie. Put a plan together. Let's keep a close eye on the Chinese.
Actually, I'm just supposed to advise and then coordinate with Seaton. I imagine he listens to you, too.
The UN inspection teams had become so accustomed to frustration that they hardly knew how to deal with satisfaction. The various staffs at the various facilities had given over reams of paper, still photographs, and videotapes, and practically raced the inspectors through the installations, pointing out the important aspects of the workings, and often demonstrating the easiest method of deactivating the more offensive features. There was the minor problem that the difference between a chemical weapons plant and a factory for insecticide was essentially nil. Nerve gas had been an accidental invention of research into killing bugs. Most insecticides are nerve poisons. And what it came down to, really, were the chemical ingredients, called precursors. Besides which, any country with oil resources and a petrochemical industry routinely produced all manner of specialized products, most of them toxic to humans anyway. But the game had rules, and one of the rules was that honest people were assumed not to produce forbidden weapons, and overnight Iraq had become an honest member of the world community. This fact was made clear at the meeting of the United Nations Security Council. The Iraqi ambassador spoke from his seat at the annular table, using charts to show what had already been opened to the inspection teams, and lamenting the fact that he'd been unable to speak the truth before. The other diplomats in the room understood. Many of them lied so much that they scarcely knew what the truth was. And so it was now that they saw truth and didn't recognize the lie behind it.
In view of the full compliance of my country with all United Nations resolutions, we respectfully request that, in view of the needs of the citizens of my country, the embargo on foodstuffs be lifted as quickly as possible, the ambassador concluded. Even his tone was reasonable now, the other diplomats noted with satisfaction.
The chair recognizes the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran, said the Chinese ambassador, who currently had the rotating chairmanship for the Security Council.
No country in this body has greater reason to dislike Iraq. The chemical weapons plants inspected today manufactured weapons of mass destruction which were then used against the people of my country. At the same time, we feel it is incumbent upon us to recognize the new day that has dawned over our neighbor. The citizens of Iraq have suffered long because of the actions of their former ruler. That ruler is gone, and the new government shows every sign of re-entering the community of nations. In view of that, the Islamic Republic of Iran will support an immediate suspension of the embargo. We will, moreover, initiate an emergency transfer of foodstuffs to bring relief to the Iraqi citizens. Iran proposes that the suspension should be conditional upon Iraq's continued good faith. To that end, we submit Draft Resolution 3659. Scott Adler had flown up to New York to take the American seat at the Council. The American ambassador to the UN was an experienced diplomat, but for some situations, the proximity of Washington was just too convenient, and this was one. For what little good it did, Adler thought. The Secretary of State had no cards to play at all. Often the cleverest ploy in diplomacy was to do exactly what your adversary requested. That had been the greatest fear in 1991, that Iraq could have simply withdrawn from Kuwait, leaving America and her allies with nothing to do, and preserving the Iraqi military to fight another day. It had been, fortunately, an option just a little too clever for Iraq to exercise. But someone had learned from that. When you demanded that someone should do something, or else be denied something that he needed, and then that person did it, well, then you could no longer deny what he wanted, could you?
Adler had been fully briefed on the situation, for all the good it did him. It was rather like sitting at a poker game with three aces after the draw, only to learn that your opponent had a straight flush. Good information didn't always help. The only thing that could delay the proceedings was the turgid pace of the United Nations, and even that had limitations when diplomats had an attack of enthusiasm. Adler could have asked for a postponement of the vote to ensure Iraqi compliance with the long-standing UN demands. But Iran had already handled that by submitting a resolution that specified the temporary and conditional nature of the embargo suspension. They'd also made it very clear that they were going to ship food anyway. In fact, already had, via truck, on the theory that doing something illegal in public made it acceptable. The Sextate looked over at his ambassador. They'd been friends for years, and caught the ironic wink. The British ambassador was looking down at a pad of penciled doodles. The Russian one was reading dispatches. Nobody was listening, really. They didn't have to. In 2 hours, the Iranian resolution would pass. Well, it could have been worse. At least he'd have a chance to speak face to face with the Chinese ambassador and ask about their naval maneuvers. He knew the answer he'd get, but he wouldn't know if it was the truth or not. Of course. "I'm the Secretary of State of the world's most powerful nation," Adler thought. "But I'm just a spectator today." Chapter 26. Weeds. There were few things sadder than a sick child. Sohaila, her name was, Dr. McGregor remembered. A pretty name for a pretty, elfin little girl. Her father carried her in his arms. He appeared to be a brutish man. That was McGregor's first impression, and he'd learned to trust them. But if so, one transformed by concern for his child. His wife was in his wake, along with another Arabic-appearing man wearing a jacket, and behind him was an official-looking Sudanese, all of which the physician noted and ignored. They weren't sick. Sohaila was.
"Well, hello again, young lady," he said with a comforting smile. "You're not feeling at all well, are you? We'll have to see about that, won't we?"
"Come with me," he said to the father. Clearly these people were important to someone, and they would be treated accordingly. McGregor led them to an examining room. The father set the little girl down on the table and backed away, letting his wife hold Suhaila's hand. The bodyguards, that's what they had to be, remained outside. The physician touched his hand to the child's forehead. She was burning up, 39 at least. Okay. He washed his hands thoroughly and donned gloves, again because this was Africa, and in Africa you took every precaution. His first considered action was to take her temperature via the ear, 39.4. Pulse was rapid, but not worrisome for a child. A quick check with a stethoscope confirmed normal heart sounds and no particular problem with the lungs, though her breathing was rapid as well. So far she had a fever, something hardly uncommon with young children, especially those recently arrived into a new environment. He looked up.
"What seems to be the problem with your daughter?"
The father answered this time.
"She cannot eat, and her other end..."
"Vomiting and diarrhea?" McGregor asked, checking her eyes out next. They seemed unremarkable as well.
"Yes, doctor." "You've arrived here recently, I believe."
He looked up when the answer was hesitation.
"I need to know."
"Correct, from Iraq, just a few days."
"And your daughter has a mild case of asthma, nothing else, no other health problems, correct?"
"That is true, yes. She's had all her shots and such. She's never been ill like this." The mother just nodded. The father clearly had taken over, probably to get the feeling of authority to make things happen, the physician surmised. It was fine with him.
"Since arriving here, any unusual things to eat?"
"You see," McGregor explained, "travel can be very unsettling to some people, and children are unusually vulnerable.
It could just be the local water.
I gave her the medicine, but it got worse, the mother said.
It is not the water, the father said, puzzled.